Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
Imagine
if there were a candidate for United States president in the year 2012 who said things like this.
If you allow this imperial presidency to continue to centralize so much power within the executive branch, it's only going to be increased in later years.
Imagine a candidate who committed to specific solutions like this.
Congress, we need to amend the War Powers Resolution.
Imagine if such a thing were really possible.
As long as people allow the spoiler issue to get in the way of voting for real change, getting out of this paradigm that we have where the Republicans and Democrats are all thriving from the same corrupt, perverse system, if you really want change, you'll make that leap.
I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio the Justice Party's nominee for U.S. President, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, a leader on issues ranging from climate protection to civil liberties to immigration reform to the impeachment of George W. Bush, on which he gave real testimony at Chairman John Conyers' phony impeachment hearing. Rocky Anderson, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's great to be with you, David, and I have very fond memories of you and I working together over the years.
Same with me, which makes me thrilled to see your name there as a possible president of my country, which a man named Eric Holder a while back told me I would soon be proud of, and yet I don't yet feel the pride. Tell me and listeners of Talk Nation Radio why you're running. What are some of the key issues where you think there is not a good candidate already on the ballot?
Well, David, I've seen this nation, our republic, being transformed in many radical ways during this past decade, both during the Bush years and the Obama years. A lot of the things that we saw during the Bush years, I think a lot of us felt were just temporary aberrations, and we would get back to some sanity in this country and a restoration of our basic, very core values. But unfortunately, it's just gotten worse. And with the two-tiered system of justice that we have, with some very elite people, usually very wealthy, very powerful, who seem to escape accountability under the law, but while the law is being applied with a vengeance toward so many millions of other people, with 2.3 million people behind bars now in our jails and prisons, by far the highest incarceration rate in the country. People serving decades in prison on their first drug offenses, while those who have helped undermine our nation's most valued principles, who have committed war crimes, who have engaged in illegal surveillance, every instance of which was a felony, that they just get off scot-free. They're not even charged, let alone tried and convicted. It's become a nation where, and I think the 99% theme is so appropriate, where there's this narrow elite political and financial class that gets away, sometimes literally, with murder, and the rest of us are suffering, with some 11 million homes underwater, valued at less than the mortgages owned on the homes, a greater disparity economically between the very few wealthy and the rest of us in this country, greater disparity in wealth and income than at any time since the 1920s. So you see all of this happening, including, of course, the utter failure of international leadership on climate change, a complete failure to resolve the immigration conflicts. We really understand now, regardless of our political party affiliation or no affiliation at all, that our government is up for sale. And it's been that way for a long time. And whether it's Republicans or Democrats, both of them are feeding at the same trough of special interest money. And that's what's controlling public policy now, while the rest of us get shafted, while the rest of us are completely betrayed by our representatives in Washington, D.C. So I just felt that this was something that has to be done. And there were others who joined together in forming the Justice Party, and we're carrying on this presidential campaign, which, as you might imagine, is the most challenging thing in the world to get over ballot access issues and to get out into the mainstream media and to get your word out. There are so many anti-democratic forces in this country that make it really difficult for third parties or independent candidates to take a run at it, regardless of the merits. But we're committed to do it, and I think that it absolutely has to be done. And if we get enough people in this country behind us, whether we win or lose the election, we can bring about dramatic change in this country.
Well, I know you've got the skills and the dedication, because I've seen it in the impeachment effort, although unsuccessful, among other efforts, and you've sold me already. But let's get into some of the details. When you talk about enforcing our laws and prosecuting our criminals, even when they are powerful, there's a pretty strong case that that ought to include people like George W. Bush and Barack Obama. On Bush's crimes, if you're talking about the warrantless spying, if you're talking about the war lies, statutes of limitations at best give us a little over 2 years at this point, counting 6 years from their last acts in office in that administration. You know, torture, if there's a dead body, there's no statute of limitations. But are you suggesting that you would come in as president and instruct the Justice Department to immediately and swiftly begin prosecuting apparent criminals, even if they were formerly people in high office?
David, especially if they're people that were in high office. We're supposed to be a nation that lives by laws, not by the rule of men, where there isn't a special class of people who think, like Richard Nixon did, that if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. That's exactly the opposite. What he was talking about was a tyranny. And what we have seen now these past 10 years is the same attitude, not only in the executive branch, but in the legislative branch, in Congress, where they won't even hold real hearings. And then, of course, in the courts, that will dismiss cases left and right simply when the perpetrator, the executive branch that has violated the law, when challenged in the courts, can go into the courts and say, we, the executive branch, have determined that to move forward with this case would mean the disclosure of important state secrets, so therefore the court needs to dismiss this case. And the courts are doing it. That means there is no check on abuses of power anymore. There is no check on an executive branch that violates the law. So my instructions to my attorney general would be, however the chips may fall, regardless of the political ramifications, regardless of what else we want to accomplish politically, we're going to say the rule of law applies. We're going to take a principled position on it. And go out and investigate, and if you find that there is reasonable cause to charge and prosecute somebody for violating the law, whether it's for illegal surveillance, whether it's for torture, whether it's for any of these other offenses, including, by the way, this is under the Convention Against Torture, it actually requires a prosecution for torture. It doesn't just leave it up to each nation. Every signatory nation agreed that we would prosecute in instances of torture. So if we're to create a legacy, continue a legacy of being a rule of law, these things have to be done. And that would be a major deviation from the Bush and the Obama years.
Rocky Anderson, the candidate for U.S. president from the Justice Party, it certainly would get around the infuriating accusation of partisanship for someone to come in from a third party and permit the prosecution of clear criminals who were members of two parties rather than one. It would be a beautiful thing to see, but then so would making the Justice Department independent of the whims of presidents. I'm sure you recall, Rocky, that when we wanted Bush impeached, one of the strongest arguments, I thought, was that whatever powers he accumulated would be handed on to the next guy and the next guy or woman, as, of course, has now happened. And what has not happened in history, to my knowledge, is for someone to come in and become president and then give powers to the Congress, give powers to the courts, give powers to the people that predecessors in the office of the president had accumulated. If you were elected, what, if any, powers would you give back?
Well, if you allow this imperial presidency to continue to centralize so much power within the executive branch, it's only going to be increased in later years. And I think probably a majority of those who supported President Obama felt that he would do the right thing and that he would stand for the rule of law. He certainly spoke poetically about it, but he's done just the opposite. He has ratcheted it up. It never seems to get ratcheted down. He has applied the state secrets doctrine more aggressively than the Bush administration. Can you imagine Democrats who are supporting President Obama right now, if it were President Bush who were in office, that signed off on legislation that allowed for the president to point the finger at anyone, including United States citizens, have them kidnapped, held up to the rest of their lives? This is what indefinite detention means. Under the National Defense Authorization Act that was just passed and signed into law by President Obama, and then never to be allowed a trial, never charged with a crime, never allowed legal representation. If that had happened under a Republican president, these Democrats that are supporting President Obama would be out in the streets, and yet they're remaining silent. That complacency is the most frightening thing of all. So very specifically, I would say as President of the United States, Congress, we need to amend the War Powers Resolution to make it very clear the president doesn't get a 60-day window of opportunity to commit troops in violation of the War Power Clause of the Constitution. The War Power Clause means what it says. The power to make war belongs to Congress solely, and Congress cannot unconstitutionally delegate that decision to the president the way it is so cowardly done ever since the Korean conflict. Secondly, I would say that we need to get back to the original Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and make it very clear, no matter who it is, it's a felony to engage in electronic surveillance of American citizens' communications without a warrant or in exigent circumstances without getting a warrant within a short period of time afterwards. I would also vastly restrict, and I'd ask Congress to pass legislation restricting the application of the state secrets doctrine. And this may seem really esoteric, difficult to understand, but it's really not. What happens under the state secrets doctrine, and it's a court-made rule, is that the executive branch can determine whether evidence that's requested in a lawsuit can be compelled to be disclosed by the executive branch, depending on the executive branch's determination as to whether that information constitutes an important state secret that would somehow implicate the national security. Well, it's interesting, the first case where that rule was derived, it turned out later on that the executive branch had lied to the courts and there were no state secrets contained in the evidence that was held back. And the courts didn't even bother, well, the Supreme Court, which reversed the Court of Appeals in the district court case in that case, didn't even bother to look at the documents that the government was claiming would disclose important state secrets. And so that's still happening. We have torture victims coming into courts, not only seeking justice, but seeking to have the truth made clear to the world about what has been happening and the illegality of these actions on behalf of the United States. And the Obama administration goes into the courts and says, no, you can't allow this to go on because to do so would implicate important state secrets. Same with illegal spying on American citizens. It's just amazing how this doctrine, how subversive it has been to our entire notion of the courts providing a check on abuses of executive power. We don't have a constitutional republic anymore. If the executive branch gets to determine what evidence comes before the courts or what cases the courts get to consider, and especially when it's the executive branch itself that is accused of engaging in illegal conduct. This is the definition of a tyranny. It's a dictatorship. And I know that sounds like an exaggeration because it's snuck up on us over the years. And if people's lives aren't directly impacted, they think everything is going along just fine. Well, the fact is, as I said earlier, our republic is being transformed dramatically before our very eyes, and we're standing back and allowing it to happen.
Rocky Anderson, the Justice Party candidate for United States President on Talk Nation Radio. This is David Swanson, your host. Rocky, I think that you don't overstate the case, even though there is perhaps not a single dictator, but a dictatorship by two parties, one of which, pick one or the other, many Americans will not criticize. So there is clearly an opening for a movement from an independent or a third party candidate, difficult as it might be. I've looked at your website, which is voterocky.org, which I recommend to everyone, and voterocky.org/solutions has a huge array of platform positions on a great many issues, from nonprofit health coverage to restoring the minimum wage to the right to organize to taxation of the rich. Let me just ask you about that one. If you were president and working with Congress, what would be your goal in terms of progressive taxation?
Well, if you look at our debt problems now, there are two very clear causes to why we're in the state we're in, with this tremendous not only accumulated debt, but the unbelievable interest burden that we're incurring and that we're handing off to our children and later generation. Those two causes are these outrageous wars and the fact that we didn't pay for them as we went along. For the first time in our nation's history, we were fighting wars and at the same time granting massive tax cuts to the wealthy. So it's like you're going out and using your credit card, driving it way up, and at the same time, you quit your job and say, we're not interested in any more revenues coming into our household. And then the second element, of course, is the loss of those revenues and those massive tax cuts for the wealthy. What we're talking about in terms of ending the job-destroying Bush tax cuts. They didn't build jobs. They actually destroyed jobs. And they've destroyed our nation's infrastructure, and they're destroying the future of this country. It would be a very minor step to getting rid of those Bush tax cuts in terms of any burden on the wealthiest in this country. We're still talking about a highest incremental level that's far below what the average has been in this country. And in fact, it would be far less even than the average during Republican administrations. But we also need to get rid of the unbelievable deductions and the ways to get around people and corporations paying their taxes. I mean, when General Electric is paying millions upon millions in income taxes in other nations and pays zero in the United States, that just shows that their investment in their lobbyists who have gotten all this special interest legislation, all these tax breaks through Congress, that it was a really good return on their investment in those lobbyists. And that really comes down to what is at the core of almost every public policy failure in this country, and that is the corrupting influence of money in our government. You just have to follow the money, whether it's the failure of the United States, the unique failure. We're the only country in the entire industrialized world that doesn't provide essential health care coverage for all of our citizens. Why is that? We know what it is. Just look at the millions upon millions that have been spent by the for-profit insurance and the pharmaceutical industries to stop any kind of real reform in our healthcare system. Look at the spending on weapons programs, things like the F-22, which was a complete anachronism. And yet, because their contractors were smart enough to get other contractors and subcontractors spread around in 44 different states, they do that for one reason, and that is to get people in Congress who want to keep that pork coming back to their districts or their states, getting them to fight for continued funding for these unnecessary weapons programs. That's how it works in Washington, D.C., and I think it's treasonous toward the American people. Our nation is hurting so badly, so many hundreds of millions of people, with 22% of children in this country now living in poverty, and we're allowing this kind of wasteful spending in our military budget. We're propping up all these just absurd military bases all around the world. It doesn't really serve our security interests anymore. This profligate spending has really hurt us as a nation in terms of, for instance, our education and providing the kind of competitive edge we need and our children need to really compete in the 21st century against students who are doing much better on their test scores in so many other countries because those countries are investing in their education. They're investing in innovation. Well, we're backing off, and well, we have a huge portion of this country complaining about what we're spending on education when they won't raise a peep against the kind of waste that we're seeing in our military budget. Have you noticed in Republican debates and in President Obama's last State of the Union address, when they talk about cutting spending, they always exempt military spending? I think that's obscene, and it's a real betrayal of all Americans' interests.
Rocky, I think you are clearly miles and miles ahead of the Republican and Democratic nominees. And if you're standing by cutting military spending at least 50%, which I saw on your website, there's no contest, and I'm with you. The question I have on the military is that I've also read support from you for the idea of humanitarian war. And of course, it is the argument that we might have a humanitarian war someday that keeps the military spending flowing, leading to, of course, many non-humanitarian wars. The Kellogg-Briand Pact banned all wars. Then we came up with the UN Charter, which said we'll ban all wars except the ones the UN likes and the ones that got called defensive, which is, of course, just about every war. Is it your position that there can be good wars?
Well, I've never used the term humanitarian war. I think that's sort of an oxymoron. What I have advocated, and I'd urge anybody to read Samantha Power's book, A Problem from Hell, about how the United States and the international community has turned an absolute blind eye toward those nations that are undergoing the tragedy of genocides. What happened in Rwanda, 800,000 people, and we didn't lift a finger.
But did they need police?
Stop that genocide.
Did they need police or did they need bombs?
They didn't need bombs. They needed, according to Romeo Dallaire, who was the UN commander, military commander on the ground, he felt no more than 5,500 United Nations troops to go in to help put an end to that genocide. George McGovern and William F. Buckley agreed as to what was going on in Cambodia, that we ought to help finance a force made up from other nations in the area to go in and put an end to the Khmer Rouge. And most people recognized it was maybe a half a dozen madmen that were leading that genocide that caused the deaths of some 2 million people and created so much tragedy. So I don't think political boundaries ought to be the definition of our responsibility, our moral responsibility, and the responsibility among nations, especially under the United Nations, to take action to stop those kinds of tragedies. And we did sign the Genocide Convention. It took years to get to that point, but to get beyond this notion that we're not going to join with the United Nations in putting an end to these kinds of tragedies. Finally, it was passed, and we actually have a legal obligation to take action to stop genocides. But it's so bad in terms of our nation's propensity to turn a blind eye that when the Rwandan genocide was happening, the Clinton administration representatives were, when asked directly, well, is this a genocide, they wanted to dodge the legal responsibility that would come with admitting that it was a genocide. And so they'd say things like, well, there appear to have been instances of genocide. So I'm talking about doing this not unilaterally, not having the United States go in and under the guise of being humanitarian, actually going in and taking over control and resources and all the like, but getting the United Nations to step up and do the right thing to help protect people in instances of genocide and other mass atrocities.
I hate to cut off this topic. I would love to get to questions of Libya and Syria and what counts as an excuse to go in. But I want to ask you, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to ask you the question that, of course, you get from everyone, but that we discussed, which is, first of all, why run in a rigged system where you will be seen as and perhaps be a spoiler? And secondly, I would add to that, tell me about Jill Stein. The two of you began running similar campaigns at a similar time. Some proposed that the two of you join together. How are you a better candidate? You know, there's no question regarding the Democrats and the Republicans, but how are you a better candidate than Jill Stein is?
Well, I think Jill Stein's a really fine, bright woman with good values. She's never held elective office. She's never held a management or executive position. I've been through it all. I practiced law for 21 years, did a lot of civil rights litigation as well as very complex antitrust and securities fraud litigation, always for the plaintiffs. But I also served 8 years over it was more than a $200 million general fund budget, a redevelopment agency budget. I was head of a major international airport. I was over thousands of employees, dealt with three major unions. So I've had vast experience, infinitely more experience in the management and executive field than Barack Obama. But I've also got a very long, solid record of standing up on the issues that, like those that you and I have talked about. Matters of war and peace, constitutional rights, fighting for people's individual liberties. I was president of the Utah ACLU affiliate and served on its board for a number of years. I've been very involved in education. So,
and the spoiler question, Rocky, in under a minute?
And as to the spoiler issue, as long as people allow the spoiler issue to get in the way of voting for real change, getting out of this paradigm that we have where the Republicans and Democrats are all thriving from the same corrupt, perverse system, if you really want change, you'll make that leap and say, this time I'm going to vote for what's right. I'm going to make a positive choice. I'm going to vote for Rocky Anderson and for the Justice Party.
It's a compelling case. Rocky Anderson, thank you for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Great talking to you.
Rocky Anderson is the candidate from the Justice Party. His website is voterocky.org. His case is a compelling one. I recommend you check him out. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.